Hello everyone, this is Harry and welcome to another episode of A2Easy. I have Sally here with me.
Hi everyone. So Harry, what are we talking about today?
So bowel obstruction, it's one of those things that's not really a true presenting complaint per se. In fact, it's more of a diagnosis with an associated constellation of symptoms and then another diagnosis underlying that.
Okay, well, I think that's possibly the worst introduction to an episode you've ever done. Please elaborate. What exactly is bowel obstruction? What are we actually learning about today?
Yeah, fair enough. It's a mechanical blockage of the bowel, so from jejunum to the rectum. The mechanical part is the critical bit. If there's no physical thing causing the symptoms, then it's not true bowel obstruction. So let's talk about the underlying causes of true mechanical bowel obstruction.
Okay, good idea. So let's say we're in an OSCE situation. We're pretty sure we're going to be walking into true bowel obstruction, or we've already clinically diagnosed it in our patient. How would we go about classifying the causes in a kind of OSCE scenario?
So the good thing about surgery is surgeons love anatomy.
Is that really a good thing?
I like it. it's simple. Okay, so look, anatomical classification is always a good idea. That's the good thing. It's always a good way to start. So firstly, we can subdivide it into small versus large bowel. Simple, okay? And from there, we can use an analogy of what the bowel really is, which is a tube. So there are problems inside the tube, problems of the tubing, and problems from outside of the tube, aka luminal, intramural, and extrinsic causes.
Okay, well, when you put it like that, anatomy is not that bad. Small bowel, large bowel, tube, outside, middle, inside the tube. I think I've got it. So if you start with the small bowel, what are we thinking?
So small bowel obstruction is more common. And some common causes are, takes deep breath in, luminal, foreign bodies such as a beezor, which I've never really heard of other than this context.
So you'd recommend in an OSCE scenario, when we're asked about the causes of bowel obstruction, the first thing we should say is a beezor.
Well, I'd say foreign body, and the example is a beezor, but also because okay. It's really fun to say. Anyway, so a beezor, for reference, is an undigestible accumulation in the tract, so which can get stuck. Moving down, intramural. So that's IBD complications, such as strictures from Crohn's disease, and other things could be cancers, like neuroendocrine tumours or from metastatic melanoma, nasty. Then finally, we've got extrinsic causes, so adhesions or hernias. And adhesions, to cut to the chase, are probably the most common cause.
And just to be super clear, what do you mean when you say adhesions?
So scar tissue in the form of fibrous bands that adhere to the bowel itself and nearby structures like the peritoneum. So a healthy bowel is flexible to a certain extent, and that means it can move around to accommodate the transit of its contents. Adhesions tie up the bowel and restrict its movements. So adhesions develop after abdominal operations, which is another reason why surgeons want to know what past operations a patient's had, and that's why, if you're wondering, the phrase virgin abdomen exists. Operations are harder to perform if the abdominal contents are all stuck together.
Okay, so previous operations can lead to adhesions, which can lead to small bowel obstruction, and that's one of the most common causes of small bowel obstruction. So we've covered common things. Is there anything else weird and wonderful we should know about, thinking, you know, SBAs, MRCP, etc.?
Yeah, there is one thing. So gallstone ileus is something you might get asked about on like a ward round, but the reason is it's because it's a misnomer, aka a stupid term which does not remotely describe the problem we're talking about, and it's there just to annoy you because, you know, what is life about whimsy? The key thing is it's not an ileus at all, aka it's not one of those functional obstructions. It's a true mechanical obstruction, and that's where the cause is a big gallstone blocking the bowel.
Okay, so I may not know my anatomy that well, but how on earth does a gallstone possibly make it through the biliary tree yet clog the small bowel? That doesn't make sense to me.
Well, you did do the biliary colic episode, so hopefully you do remember your biliary tree anatomy.
Anyway, I do, and it doesn't make sense, I'm telling you.
You're right, and it generally doesn't make sense, but, and this is why it's rare. So, as an example, I have seen a 3 centimeter single gallstone obstruct someone's bowel. 3 centimeters is too big for the biliary tree. So there has been a diversion, okay? Gallbladder inflammation can manifest in a number of ways. One of those is via fistula formation, where the gallbladder and the small bowel connect, circumventing the biliary tree entirely. The fistula is mostly between the gallbladder and the duodenum, so it's a cholecystoduodenal fistula.
Of course. I can't even say it, Harry.
Yeah, we can keep that in, that's good. Of course, a cholecystoduodenal fistula. How obvious. Anyway, that's enough about the small bowel. Let's move on to the large bowel. Common cases include, ready for the list again, luminal, fecal impaction and foreign bodies, intramural, colon cancer and diverticular strictures and IBD complications once again. And then extrinsic, cancers from other places, such as compression from a gynae malignancy, or other options could be a volvulus or hernias again. Colon cancer is the most common example. This is how a cancer can present acutely and get diagnosed in ED.
So when dealing with a patient with bowel obstruction, especially acutely, you need to keep the possibility of an underlying malignancy in mind?
Yeah, of course. So normally we think of colorectal cancer as this triad of change in bowel habit, unexplained iron deficiency anemia, and weight loss. That is a chronic insidious presentation. The bit you might not be aware of is that the change in bowel habit is classic of left-sided cancers, and the unexplained iron deficiency anemia is more classic of right-sided cancers. But these aren't hard and fast rules. Colorectal cancers can eventually grow big enough so that it can block the lumen, causing a mechanical obstruction. We covered this a long time ago, but can you remember which location of colorectal cancer, aka left or right-sided, typically can do that?
Ooh, I'm gonna go with...
It's 50-50, it's 50-50.
I'm gonna go with left.
Correct. Good guess. So, for this, it's helpful to think of the GI tract as one long, simple tube again. And what goes in is food, and what ends up at the other end is feces. It's a truly magical journey. The small and large bowel play different roles in the absorption, and true feces is only really formed in the colon. So, when the GI content enters from the terminal ileum to the proximal end of the colon, it's liquid at that stage. As it passes through the ascending colon, water reabsorption converts the content to solid stool. So the liquid can just flow past a proximal right-sided tumour, but solid stool can get stuck passing the tumour in the left side, aka the distal part of the colon, because it's solidified, essentially.
Okay, I think I understand that. But can we just rewind slightly and go back to the list? When you were covering the luminal, intramural and extrinsic causes of large bowel obstruction, you said another word that I find quite difficult to say, volvulus. Can we just recover what does that mean? Because I don't think we've actually explained that yet.
Yeah, sure, fine. So let's say we've spoken about colon cancers, we've spoken about them getting stuck, and so for volvulus instead, it's helpful to imagine the bowel as a really long balloon rather than just a simple tube, and a balloon that curves around a lot, okay? Remember, okay. Balloons can get twisted and turn into shapes. And a volvulus is a bit like an ear of a dog. But
Balloon dog?
And a balloon dog, that's better. Not a balloon dog. A balloon dog. But to help, I think I'll put a link of an image in the description so you can have a look. As it curves around, the two parts of the bowel can coil around each other, twisting again and again around each other and becoming like a tight spiral, aka a volvulus. And apparently that comes from the Latin word meaning to roll, which Dan will be very excited that I've mentioned.
I mean, that is pretty cool, to be fair. So volvulus is the Latin word to roll, and it's kind of this twisting or rolling action where you completely collapse the bowel lumen around the transition point, right? And it causes a mechanical obstruction.
Yeah, although transition point is linked to a pediatric condition, but I'm not going to say it's the wrong term.
Okay, I'm so sorry.
Remember, so it's a twisting around of two piece segments of the bowel causing a mechanical obstruction. Correct. So far we've spoken about what bowel obstruction is and its common underlying causes. In terms of epidemiology, it's difficult to say because it depends on the underlying cause of the bowel obstruction. However, let's be honest, given that adhesions occur after surgery and colorectal cancer is not common in young people, I would suggest that typically patients are middle-aged or older.
Okay, no, that makes sense to me.
Just guesswork.
No stats here, people. We're not that professional. So I guess apart from the epidemiology of each underlying cause, there isn't really a generalized pattern to suggest which patients are going to develop bowel obstruction and which ones aren't. So when a patient comes into ED or when a patient is in an OSCE station, what are we looking for in terms of presentation? How do patients with bowel obstruction present?
So symptoms-wise, patients tend to present with generalized abdominal pain with no bowel movements since the onset of their symptoms. And the important question to ask is whether they are still passing flatus.
Yes, I mean, it makes sense, right? Because if there is a mechanical blockage, which air cannot pass through, then they won't be passing flatus, and we can say it's mechanical.
Indeed. So abdo pain, constipated, and not passing flatus, or passing wind, or farting, or whatever normal phrase you want to use, because most people have not heard of the word flatus. Anyway, as the obstruction goes on for a while, the patient will start to vomit, because simply put, if it can't go out the normal way, it will just come back up and eventually go out the way it came. Can you think why the type of vomit produced is notable here?
So I guess we've already divided the bowel obstruction anatomically into small and large bowel obstruction, and I'm guessing that's somehow related?
It is to a certain extent. And so in severe large bowel obstruction, you can have fecalant vomiting. The issue is that that can also happen in distal small bowel obstruction, and that's because the content gets backed up right by the obstruction, stagnating and turning brown. So it looks like fecalant vomiting. The other option for large bowel obstruction is the patient might not even vomit at all, so it's not a very good discriminating marker either. And this can happen in patients with a competent ileocecal valve, which I'll be honest, we're not going to talk about a huge amount here because I've mentioned it in a different episode when we're talking about abdo x-rays. So have a look at that if you want to know more about that. More classically though, you should remember that in small bowel obstruction, the small bowel will be distended and not be working properly. So normally, you would have an effective enterohepatic circulation, which recycles bile. A lot of that is reabsorbed via the intestinal tract normally. This can't happen in small bowel obstruction. So you have roughly like a litre of bile being made a day that can't be reabsorbed or fecally excreted. So that leads to bile-filled vomit, bilious vomiting.
So bilious vomiting for small bowel obstruction and fecalant vomiting is more likely to be associated with large bowel obstruction, but can occur in small bowel obstruction as well. Is that right?
Yeah, it's confusing. Yeah, so I'd say that fecalant is less of a discriminant sign, but bilious is more classic for small bowel obstruction. And if they're not vomiting at all, that can also happen in large bowel obstruction.
Okay, I think that's clear. Maybe let's move on to signs on examination.
Yeah, well, so remember, you should always do your needlessly overdramatic general inspection.
Of course.
To prove to the examiner that you are definitely doing one. Okay, so channel your inner dramatic human being. And you look around the bed, you look under the bed, in the closet, out the window, in the car park, whatever. If you do happen to find a vomit bowl on your travels, do not be shy. Look into it, and you're going to look for its colour, consistency, and volume. You should always check for blood, upper GI bleeds, all that kind of thing. But it might be bile-coloured in small bowel obstruction, and if they vomited litres and litres, you should probably bear that in mind when you're thinking about their fluid balance, because they've clearly lost litres and litres. When we finally get around to actually looking at the patient, which is why we're here, they will probably look unwell, as the end of the bedogram will tell you. Given we always start by looking in their hands, remember the patient with an underlying cancer might have leukonychia for iron deficiency anemia, and they might appear pale. In a younger person, looking for signs of IBD might be helpful here. But to be honest, all the things I've just mentioned are not diagnostic for anything, and they don't diagnose the main problem at hand. So really, this is all about the abdomen. First off, the abdomen is likely to be distended. In thin people, this might not be as obvious at the bedside as you first think. So asking patients if their tummy looks normal for them at present is often really helpful to give you context. It's the outward manifestation of bowels being distended. You should also, as always, look for any obvious abdominal surgical scars, which might suggest adhesions as an underlying precipitant. Tip, just ask them, any scars that I can't see. It's a classic get out of jail free card. It gets you so far in finals. On palpation, moving on, there will be tenderness with guarding. Proper, involuntary guarding. If the bowel obstruction is severe enough to have caused perforation by this point in time, then this would be present as a rigid abdomen, aka a peritonitic abdomen. In terms of auscultation, normal bowel sounds will be absent. What kind of sounds might you hear, Sally?
Bad sounds. I've only heard these once.
Bad sounds?
And I was in first year, and it was like my first medical placement, and I was really scared of my consultant. And it was maybe like the third or fourth ward round. And he kind of came over to us and was like, put your stethoscope there. And he was like, what do you hear? And I was like, I don't know. And he was like, tinkling, you hear tinkling. And I was like, okay. So yeah, tinkling bowel sounds, I think, is the right answer from that one and only experience.
And I have to be honest, I should say, I only actually ever heard it since I became a doctor.
Wow. I don't feel so bad now.
Yeah, well, you heard him in first year, lucky. I've got to say, I think a lot of things, because you see more patients in quick succession as a doctor. So some things you might not hear. And a lot of things I convinced myself that I heard when I was a medical student, and then actually that was not the thing I was hearing, which is awkward. So if that happens to you, don't be alarmed, anyone out there. Anyway, they are high-pitched popping sounds, and I don't know if you agree, but I think they sound a bit like dropping a stone or like a penny into a well. That's how I kind of describe it.
Yeah, yeah, like kind of many pennies.
Many pennies, yeah.
Many pennies.
And so what's actually happening here is that fluid is dripping into the dilated bowel, which is now big, cavernous, and that leads to this high-pitched dripping sound. Annoyingly, I spent ages going through Google and I just can't find a decent example of this to link to you guys. But one reassuring thing I can say, and hopefully you'd agree, is no matter how you describe them, they do just sound pretty different to normal bowel sounds. They're weird, they don't happen constantly, so you'll hopefully better spot them. What we suggest is we suggest listening to the bowel sounds in two places for up to a minute in gold standard practice. And if you think you heard a tinkling bowel sound, I would genuinely just listen for that time. The other thing to do that everyone always forgets to do at medical school is examine for hernias. Everyone always forgets in almost every exam. Quick ways to make them more obvious, that hernias that is asking the patient to cough whilst you're examining them. That increases the intra-abdominal pressure. Or you can let gravity do some of the work for you and ask them to stand up. And hopefully then the hernia will make itself known due to gravity.
Okay, so with all of that in mind, you've now examined the patient. They've got half a litre of dark green, bilious looking vomit on their table, all over themselves. They have a gridiron scar from an appendectomy they had as a child. They're generally tender with rebound and percussion tenderness. They have no hernias because we've checked.
Well done, you checked for hernias.
Extremely thoroughly and asked them to cough a lot of times. Now what?
So it sounds suspicious for bowel obstruction, wouldn't you? And I wouldn't rule out a perforation at this stage either. You've got to have an open mind. So you probably might consider doing a dramatic A2E approach. And after that, you'd then do some investigations or slash as part of that.
Okay, what investigations are you thinking?
Well, of course, for us, we'll do bedside bloods and imaging. Bedside here is limited to the examination you've just done. There is no blood test to diagnose obstruction, unfortunately, but you do need to do a proper initial screen to assess for complications and see if they hint at an underlying cause. So here is a list that you will forever remember, I'm sure. FBC, because if they're anemic, you should do an extended screen, aka hematinics, folate, B12, and then euxinese with extended electrolyte panel, so that's magnesium, calcium, phosphate, and then you do LFTs, clotting, group and save, and a VBG. Lots of things associated with bleeding, basically.
But why are we interested in the extended electrolyte checks and a VBG? I'm in my ED mindset. This is all a waste of my time.
So bowel obstruction tends to cause electrolyte derangement, okay? Volvulus in particular, from what I have seen clinically. Remember, all that absorption has stopped, so you have poor electrolyte intake, but worse than that, the dilated bowel tends to encourage electrolyte-rich fluid to leak into the lumen. Do you remember what we said before about pseudo-obstruction? Similar vibe.
Mm-hmm.
So that leads to blood electrolyte abnormalities, which you need to screen for, and hypokalemia is specifically quite common.
Okay. Fair, you've justified that one, but why the VBG?
Well, really, it's because they give you a quick indication of how sick someone is, and I suppose an approximation of their electrolytes, but you know, you'd want a formal reading for some stuff just to really check what's going on. But we're also interested in the lactate here, is the other thing I should say. Mesenteric ischemia is a potential differential here, and that's for someone with severe abdominal pain. But the other thing is, a raised lactate in general is just a bad sign. So given this patient's pretty unwell, it might help you demonstrate this and prove it to other people.
Okay, no, that's fair enough. So what about imaging? We said bedside tests, we've done bloods, imaging.
Look, come on. No. This is general surgery. Take a guess at the ideal imaging modality.
Okay, I think, again, if I was going to take a guess, stab in the dark, I would say CT abdo-pelvis with contrast. Would that make the surgeons happy?
Yeah, CT adipelvis with contrast makes everyone happy. That is pretty much always the right answer. That is the gold standard. We love a CT adipelvis with contrast. But also, it's reason to keep an eye on you. But also, because you're giving contrast, you should keep an eye on their renal function, which is one of the reasons you want to do it before, because contrast can cause nephropathy.
Yeah, good point. And also check their allergies. Also very important.
Yes, very true. Ooh, allergies.
Any other tests that we're thinking of?
Well, there is another test I can think of, but weirdly, this kind of ties in with the management of bowel obstruction. So we'll kind of come to that in a bit.
Yeah, can't disrupt the podcast schedule. Very important. So let's say that our CT comes back in record quick time and it shows small bowel obstruction without perforation, and the radiologist thinks it's probably adhesional bowel obstruction as well. How would we manage this patient, Harry?
Well, I probably would not manage them on my own, for starters, to be honest. As I suggested earlier, A2E is important, and when first seeing this kind of patient, that's the mainstay. And then given the likely diagnosis, you might try a bunch of conservative measures, and that would be done after consulting with a senior. Can you think of what conservative measures we might try?
Drip and suck?
Yeah, so it's the phrase used to describe IV fluids and insertion of a Ryles NG tube, nasogastric tube. Ryles are for decompressing the bowel, i.e. draining all the backed up content, and as such have a larger lumen than the regular feeding NG tube. When it's inserted, you will probably immediately drain some gut content. This will make the patient feel a lot better. And as you take the pressure off, I've often just sat there with a big syringe and aspirated the tube till it's fairly dry and recorded how much I've taken off. As a doctor, not as a medical student. Anyway, coming back to the drip part, you give the fluid because you can reasonably assume that with all that high volume vomits and all the things you've just taken off via the syringe, that they have become dehydrated. But also, that means they haven't had much proper absorption. As this is a condition with a potentially surgical management, making them nil by mouth is also sensible and also helps justify you giving the IV fluids, frankly. Given that they may need surgery and have a propensity to become extremely unwell, you need to be escalating to a senior because they might opt for surgical management.
Okay, so drip and suck can also testify that, yeah, sitting there with the syringe is possibly the most satisfying job you can do as an F1. I would highly recommend it. So that's conservative management. What about medical, surgical? Do we have any options there?
So medical management ties in with the old way of investigating bowel obstruction. Before CT was widely more available, we would often do abdo x-rays and erect chest x-rays to look for bowel obstruction and perforation. To make the bowel shut better, we would give an oral contrast agent, and that was called, what is called, gastrographin. However, we have slowly realised that it could have a therapeutic role as well, because people tended just to get a little bit better, and things tend to work itself out after we gave them the contrast. So there's a growing evidence base that in adhesional small bowel obstruction, which sounds niche initially, but remember, adhesion is probably the most common cause, it can be effective. So gastrographin is a hypertonic solution, which the body balances by drawing fluid into the lumen. So fluid gets chucked in there, and that helps reduce the intestinal wall swelling, the intestinal wall edema, and it stimulates peristalsis. Giving that gastrographin can help avoid the operation.
Okay, so gastrographin, hyperosmolar, fluid into the lumen, less bowel wall edema can help in adhesional small bowel obstruction. Nice. And if that doesn't work or isn't appropriate for some reason?
Well, normally we don't deep dive straight into operating unless we think the benefits outweigh the risks. When possible, you should really just do a trial of conservative management. So drip and suck is ideal to see if removing the pressure on the bowel gives it a chance to sort of recover and resolve from the obstruction. After a period of time, which is probably ultimately down to senior clinical judgment, a surgical approach would be considered, or I say could be considered. Remember, not all patients will be fit for this procedure, and it's major surgery, so the type of operation will depend on the underlying cause of the bowel obstruction and what is actually affected. For example, for a volvulus, you can fix the problem by inserting a flatus tube per rectum, which is the, as the name suggests, it's a tube that allows the passage of air. It can be inserted on the ward with a rigid sigmoidoscope, if that's tolerated by the patient. The sigmoidoscope is something you might be asked to spot on an images and instrument station in final year, but to be honest, you really need to insert it under direct visualization due to the potential risk of perforation. So more often than not, it's done using a flexible sigmoidoscope in an endoscopy suite instead. When the tube is threaded into the volvulus, immediately you will notice a difference as the flatus tube passes through, and it's kept in place with tape, often for a period of time afterwards, just to help further decompress the bowel and avoid it from happening again instantly. If it's an adhesional small bowel obstruction, the patient could undergo adhesiolysis, aka cutting of those adhesions, which will also typically involve evaluation of the bowel segment in question, the thing that's obstructed, to make sure it isn't dead and in need of resecting.
Okay, yep, so flatus tube insertion for a volvulus, something I also got to see as an F1, satisfying in quite a different way from the drip and suck. And then if it's adhesional, you can undergo sort of a surgical intervention of adhesiolysis, right? But I guess I've also seen situations where the patient's in theatre and has gone under the knife, and actually the bowel isn't in as great a shape as maybe we anticipated when they were sitting on the ward with bowel obstruction. What's the situation then? What can we do?
So this is the part of the territory where you tend to remove a piece of bowel, and that's where you get the operations that end in ectomy. Given this to be an emergency where the bowel is not in the greatest shape, as you said, many surgeons would opt to remove the section of bowel and then bring the proximal end to the skin as a stoma. And that will be called an ileostomy if it's part of the ileum, or colostomy, depending on if it's part of the colon. And then you'd leave the distal part, the part that's left over, to sort of rest and heal. And that would be what's called a double-barreled stoma, for reference. That's where both ends of the bowel are brought to the skin, but the distal end doesn't really function because you've brought it to the skin and then the contents fall out into a bag. If no bowel was actually removed at all, but the plan is for the bowel to be given time to rest and defunction via a stoma, a loop stoma could be made. And that's where you've got an incomplete cut into the bowel. This is a very specific type of surgery. Incomplete cut. And so that means there are two ends which are brought forward and both of them are brought to the skin. That's a loop stoma. It's just whether there's a bit of a posterior wall connecting between the two segments. In a double-barreled stoma, there isn't that. When the gut has had some time to calm down and heal, the patient is more medically well, you know, a rejoining procedure can be attempted on an elective basis. So one operation which is common but bucks the trend and is eponymously named is the Hartmann's procedure, rather than ones that just end in ectomy. But to put it plainly, this is a sigmoid colon ectomy, where you tie the remaining distal segment off at the rectum as a rectal stump. If the surgeon had attempted to remove the segment and join the remaining ends back together in the same procedure, that's different. That will be called a primary anastomosis. And I think that's probably enough surgical options, to be honest with you. That's sort of a nutshell into different types of stomas and different types of colon operations. Otherwise, we'll just end up describing every single one. It'll be a complete nightmare. But what you need to really know is there are lots of surgical potential options. So just saying we would do surgery is not enough. You need to know what kind of operation would be appropriate. But that's probably higher level than, you know, what we're going for today.
Yeah, I mean, that was too high level for me, Harry. But
sorry if I lost you.
No, I think it makes sense. As we said, so volvulus, we're thinking a flatus tube insertion. Adhesions, we can do adhesiolysis. But if there is a blocked segment of bowel that's not in great shape, a bit of ischemia or long-term obstruction, removal of that segment is a common approach. One example being a Hartmann's, which is an end colostomy formation with a rectal stump. Would that get me enough marks in my OSCE?
That'll get you fantastic marks. Fantastic marks.
Thank you. Just caveat, neither of us are OSCE examiners, so don't take anything we say as gospel.
Not right now. Anyway, spoiler alert. Okay. Anyway, moving on to complications, we've already alluded to some of the main ones during this episode, fortunately. So it's one of the really serious complications is bowel perforation, because that can cause intra-abdominal sepsis, because the feces gets out, causes peritonitis, infection, and eventually death. Plus, the other one we've already spoken about is electrolyte derangement, and that's common and can also be life-threatening. Fortunately, there are treatments available, as I've just said, so I suppose we don't need to end this on an entirely downbeat note. Those are your two main complications. But we can potentially fix bowel obstruction via conservative medical or surgical mechanisms.
Amazing. So is that it? Have we finished bowel obstruction?
I think that's it. I think everyone can rest easy now.
Great.
True bowel obstruction is where there is a mechanical blockage in the bowel. Gastrointestinal content gets backed up and the bowel becomes distended. We typically talk about small or large bowel obstruction, the former being more frequent. The most common underlying cause of small bowel obstruction is adhesions. For large bowel obstruction, it's colorectal cancer, but another cause to be aware of is sigmoid volvulus. Patients present with nausea, vomiting, abdominal pain, and are unable to open their bowels or pass flatus. On general inspection, inspect any vomit. Feculent or bilious vomiting are suggestive of bowel obstruction. On examination, abdominal distension, tenderness, and guarding are common. A rigid peritonitic abdomen is suggestive of perforation. On auscultation, high-pitched tinkling bowel sounds are a classic sign of bowel obstruction. For bloods, it's an initial screen to check for signs of peritonitis and electrolyte derangement, plus the standard tests in case they need an operation. FBC, CRP, UNEs, magnesium, calcium, phosphate, LFTs, clotting, group and save, and a venous blood gas. For imaging, a CT abdo-pelvis with contrast is ideal. To manage bowel obstruction conservatively, you can trial a drip and suck regimen. Alongside, give them appropriate analgesia and make them nil by mouth. Medical treatment includes a trial of oral gastrographin for adhesional small bowel obstruction. Invasive options depend on the underlying cause, such as adhesionolysis for adhesions or flatus tube insertion for volvulus. If the distended bowel segment has become necrotic, bowel resection is necessary, which can lead the patient with a stoma. Complications of bowel obstruction include electrolyte derangement and life-threatening perforation and subsequent peritonitis.